You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, for the Columbia Calling podcast here in Mompós, Bolívar. That's 5 hours south from Cartagena on Colombia's Caribbean coast. And this is episode number 337. And it's a political episode because we have the director of Colombia Risk Analysis, a great friend to the Colombia Calling podcast, Sergio Guzman, and his colleague who's in Washington, Cameron Wilson, who is the author of the recent report done for Colombia Risk Analysis called Defining His Legacy. And it's a look at the final 2 years, because we're at the midway point, but the final 2 years of President Duque's tenure as the premier in Colombia. So a very interesting time, a very interesting conversation with Wilson, who's in Washington, D.C., and Guzman, who is in Bogota. So we're all in our different areas under quarantine, but discussing one unified conversation, and that is Colombian politics this week. And of course, in the wake of former President Álvaro Uribe's, house arrest, order of house arrest for alleged witness tampering in a case, and of course, sent down with this term, house arrest by the Supreme Court, we'll be discussing this and what that means for President Duque, that his political godfather has been, but there has to be some pretty compelling evidence to put Álvaro Uribe under house arrest. So yes, Colombia is more polarized than ever, and the discussion this week will be around that. So of course, stay tuned for a fantastic conversation with two experts in their field of politics, international relations, and of course, Colombia. Don't go away. I'll leave you in the capable hands of Emily Hart, who's our newscaster, and she will be bringing you the news from Colombia. And then we'll be back with Sergio Guzman and Cameron Wilson of Colombia Risk Analysis talking to us about the report and about what's going on politically and what are the consequences and possible consequences of these actions for the final 2 years of President Duque's tenure as president here in Colombia. Thank you again. Don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Colombia Calling for the week of August 10th, 2020. Colombia has now surpassed 12,000 COVID-19 deaths, with recorded cases at over 375,000. Intensive care units are now at around 90% capacity in Bogotá, Cali, Bucaramanga, and Medellín. Lockdowns are being partially reimposed across the country. Just one news story this week. In a historic move, the Supreme Court of Colombia has detained former President Álvaro Uribe. He is under house arrest, pending charges of witness tampering and bribery. Uribe was president from 2002 to 2010, and is still a senator and leader of the hard-right ruling party, the Centro Democrático. Uribe's administration was marked by a wide range of human rights violations. During his presidency, right-wing paramilitary groups grew in number and power. He led a flawed demobilization process which triggered the creation of new armed groups, many of which are still engaged in violent crime across Colombia, routinely implicated in the killings of human rights defenders. In 2011, Senator Iván Cepeda produced testimony that Uribe and his brother had participated in the creation of the Metro Bloc, part of the paramilitary group United Self-Defense Forces. In 2012, further evidence was given that the group had been founded at the Uribe family hacienda, in collaboration with brothers Santiago and Pedro Gayón Henao, both accused of drug trafficking. Uribe then accused Cepeda of fabricating that evidence. So between 2015 and 2018, the Supreme Court investigated Cepeda, according to Uribe's accusations, which were indoctrinating witnesses. In 2018, the court's conclusion was that Cepeda was not merely innocent, but actually the victim of Uribe, who had himself fabricated witness testimonies to back up his accusations. The trial of Uribe's then-lawyer, Diego Cadena, is, as of last week, underway. He is being prosecuted for bribery and procedural fraud. The Supreme Court now has evidence that Uribe was not only aware of his lawyer and allies manipulating and bribing witnesses, but that he was actively complicit. Colombia's divided reaction to this news has reflected its deep polarization on the issue of Uribe and his legacy. Many cities saw celebrations as well as protests against his detention. President Iván Duque, Uribe's protege, has leapt to his defense, saying that he should be free to defend himself at liberty, calling him a person who served his country with patriotism and honor. His party is also advocating their leader's innocence, taking out pages of newspapers to comment and calling for overhaul of the justice system. Cepeda himself has announced that he is looking into legal action against the now president for his statements about the case, which he deems constitute undue pressure on the judiciary and attacks on the independence of the court. Uribe is in his home, awaiting proceedings. He will continue to lead the party, though he is no longer allowed to attend congressional sessions. Days after his house arrest began, however, Uribe claimed to have tested positive for COVID-19, along with his two sons, though his team have told press he is not showing any symptoms. That was the week's news bulletin. Now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the Columbia Calling podcast, segment 3 of episode 337. I'm Richard McCall here in Mompos Bolivar, the sweltering lowlands in the Magdalena River Valley. The Magdalena River is only about 20 meters behind me as I sit here. Our very special guests are on the line from Washington, D.C. and Bogota. We have the director of Columbia Risk Analysis, Sergio Guzman, known to all of you out there if you read anything about Colombia, because Sergio is the most quotable man on Colombian issues, and his the MA student Johns Hopkins Cameron Wilson, who is also the author of the Columbia Risk Analysis recent report, which is called Defining His Legacy, and it's talking about the potential for what might happen in the final 2 years of President Iván Duque's tenure in Colombia. So interesting times, as always, in Colombia. And, well, thank you to these two guys for signing on and agreeing to being on the podcast.
Thanks, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, it's always a pleasure to have you. And so the idea is, obviously, as always, is to, you know, give my listeners a little bit of an idea of what's going on. And, you know, there's going to be no way around this conversation today without mentioning President Iván Duque's mentor, former president, until Tuesday of last week, acting senator for the Centro Democrático Party, Álvaro Uribe Vélez. This is a huge deal, what's going on there. It's a huge deal. He's been given house arrest for, it's alleged witness tampering in a case that he started against opposition politician Iván Cepeda, and it came round to kind of kick him in the butt. Before we get into the report and the blood and guts of the report, can we just get, I don't know, a few minutes on Álvaro Uribe and what's happened, and let's just try and give a nice overview without too much hubris.
Okay, well, I'll give it a shot. Uribe is the most divisive man in Colombian recent history, so to speak. He has passion in his followers and his opponents alike, and they're fervent in their sentiment about him. Cepeda has been an opponent of Uribe for a very long time, since Cepeda's father, also Iván Cepeda, a senator, was killed in 1994. And so Cepeda, like Uribe in his moment, pledged to avenge his father. And one way that Cepeda has been working on that is to find out the culprits of terror. And since 1994, Cepeda, through several organizations, has been trying to uncover and unmask the intellectual authors of his father's killing. And when Uribe became president, and obviously the cases around paramilitarism started becoming much more in vogue, Cepeda, alongside a person named Jorge Rojas, wrote the book called A las Puertas del Ubérrimo, basically at the front doors of Uribe's Finca, to describe how the entire Córdoba paramilitarism phenomenon occurred in front of Uribe's eyes, basically.
Yeah.
Long story short, Cepeda has been contending that Duque and that Uribe has had ties to paramilitary groups all the way back to when he was governor.
Mm-hmm.
And Uribe contends that Cepeda has been bribing witnesses to obtain testimony that discredits him. And so when both of these men were senators and were elected to the Senate in 2014, Uribe basically accused formally Ivan Cepeda of bribing witnesses in order to have them say testimony that was unfavorable to then Senator Uribe. And so the court took this case seriously because it's a very serious accusation, and they wiretapped a bunch of individuals who were these witnesses. And what the court decided after the investigation was that Ivan Cepeda was absolved of him trying to tamper witnesses to get them to change their testimony, but called Duque and subpoenaed Uribe to testify for them doing the same exact thing. Because according to transcripts, lawyers representing Uribe had been the ones who were trying to get witnesses to change their testimony to mud Cepeda's own evidence.
Hmm.
So this is a case of, you know, complete Schadenfreude for many people who are looking at Uribe, who instigated this investigation, who's now stands accused of the very same thing that he accused Cepeda of doing.
Hmm.
So I think it's very I want to make this clear to your listeners, because a lot of the people who are defending Uribe are saying, well, how come, you know, Uribe, a man with such legacy, a man with such power, an upstanding Colombian citizen, how is he being treated so unfairly? And the issue is, you know, Uribe's legacy, Uribe's 20 years in politics, Uribe's tenure as president of Colombia is not being litigated.
Mm.
What is being litigated is whether or not witness tampering and false processes, obstruction of justice, took place. That should be the nut graph of this case.
Mm.
And the Constitutional Court would never proceed, knowing how sensitive the issue is, unless it had pretty sweeping evidence of the facts that are alleged to have taken place.
Yeah, you got it all there. It's all there. I was watching the news footage of the pro Uribe camp out there in their cars along the Septima and in Medellin and beeping their horns. And obviously Twitter and all social media exploded for and against. And I'm watching people saying, oh, you know, the corruption of the court. And I'm going to say, doesn't this show that the court, the Supreme Court is independent? Doesn't this show? I mean, how likely, and this will be my final thing on this element, how likely is it that the court is affected in some way, or could we say that there is corruption within the court that has led to this decision being made?
Well, the issue, I think, is more complicated, because the court, to some Colombians, is never going to be legitimate by virtue of this decision, but by virtue of many others, right? At the same time, there are some corruption allegations against former magistrates of both the Supreme Court and the Constitutional Court that make it very difficult for Colombians to guarantee 100% that the court is free of corruption. And so one of the things that I see that are coming is, you know, a campaign to delegitimize the court, but potentially a huge reform that's going to be introduced by the ruling party to try to change the court system and how it is, in an effort also to help Uribe's case, but also because the court system is going to be perceived as illegitimate. But it's important to say that the other half of the country believes that the court acted according to the rule of law, that nobody's above the law, and that this case demonstrates upstanding judicial independence, even to the most powerful man of Colombia.
Yeah.
And so I understand those two visions. I do think that nobody in Colombia is or should be or can be above the law. And I don't think also that that it's equivalent, that the judicial equivalences between the FARC and Uribe at this point are fair because of the nature of the cases specifically that they're being addressed and how they're being addressed and in which courts they're being done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your listeners are going to hear a lot of negative campaigning and stuff about the courts. You know, the courts are not perfect, but they're, in this case, they haven't acted unfairly because they know what's at stake. And they've been extremely judicious at minding their business for this case.
Yeah.
Having said that, you know, I look forward to talking about this for years and years that it's going to continue.
Well, very good and very diplomatically put, as I would expect from, you know, a political consultant here in Colombia and of course, covering your back there. But now, Cameron, you authored this report, you know, you are the principal author of this, you know, defining his legacy. Of course, the Uribe decision comes in and I don't think it changes your report wholly. It just adds a whole new chapter to it in terms of what can we expect for Duque's final 2 years. Maybe you could give us a little bit of an overview of the report and what you guys at Colombia Risk Analysis had envisaged for President Duque in these final 2 years.
Sure. Well, the main idea was to look at what's in the pipeline for President Duque and his administration, which basically means what's the agenda for the Democratic Center or the Centro Democrático. And for less familiar listeners, that's Uribe's party, which we just covered its trajectory lately. And to most people, Uribe is sort of the mastermind behind the party. He founded it. He puts forth candidates for Senate, for president. He sort of sets the policy agenda. Some people would argue about to what extent he picks cabinet ministers, but everybody agrees he has some influence. So we wanted to look and see what was coming in the next couple of years for President Duque. And the idea was to look at that through the lens of six or seven of the most pressing issues in Colombian society. And there are many, as we all know. And so we focused on Colombia navigating its historically strong ties to the U.S. with, let's say, growing Chinese influence in Latin America. We focused on what the expected policy is towards Venezuela. We focused on what will be some economic and fiscal strategies to sort of right the ship, right? The ship is listing right now. It's taking on water. And so what are the ways you can fill the hole? We looked at also the social unrest that was a real theme last fall, all around Latin America, but in Colombia as well, and tried to piece together, what the trajectory looks like on the variety of issues that cause people to amass in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And all that taken together, represented a group of forecasts and one sort of overarching conclusion, if I may, that ties into the latest saga with Álvaro Uribe, which is that if President Duque is to govern the country in a way that lets it recover from the crisis, in a sense, to sort of manage through the crisis in a way that's most equitable and fair to all Colombians, that would require him leaving behind some of the ideals and the policies that are form the backbone of mm-hmm. the party that he's in. But to do that would require him you know, leaving behind the mechanism that got him to the office in the first place. He would have to sort of lose the trust and faith of the people that put him in office, like Uribe. And so to him, it's a very stark choice. And if anything, the loyalty that he's shown to Uribe in the last day, sort of decrying the court's decision, why is Uribe going to house arrest when we're looking at the light punishment for ex-FARC leaders, you know, that makes it clear sort of what tack he's going to take already. I don't think we were expecting such a clear indication so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I find this very interesting indeed, is that over the last, let's say 6 months or so, President Duque has had the opportunity to, let's say, distance himself a little bit from the hardcore of his party and perhaps move somewhat to the center, not to the center, but somewhat to the center, and build, I don't even want to say bridges, but sort of relationships with the opposition a little bit to be able to push through some of his desires and mandate. And he didn't do it, but he has moved in that he's, you know, put people from, again, I would say right of center parties into Cambio Radical and U party people into positions of authority. So, I mean, that is something that he has done. But I suppose, as we're saying, we don't expect him to make any extreme decisions to say, listen, I need to do this. I need to reach out to the opposition, to the Greens, and to whomever else. As you said, Cameron, the saga that has been unfurling in the last few days, and even prior to the announcement by the court and prior to Uribe's announcement on Twitter of his house arrest, Duque had already, given a statement saying that he believed strongly in the honesty, integrity, and the word of the former presidents. All these words that are always used, the good name, honesty, integrity, gente de bien, and all the stuff that's always said here. I don't suspect we're going to see any volte-face by Duque on this, but then, I mean, my overall feeling then is, okay, so the political mentor for Duque is under house arrest, but he'll still be the mentor. It doesn't end with this. So, I mean, referring to President Duque's agenda for the upcoming couple of years, I suspect, I mean, were the coronavirus or COVID-19 not an issue, we would still be having large social movements and demonstrations on the streets, because I'm sure that the national dialogue, in inverted commas, would be, again, a huge representation of how to delay anything, because that's what it looked like. Sort of, it almost looked like sort of 150 people around a table and nobody getting to speak. But so, I mean, what can we expect? Let's focus on one thing. What can we expect for the peace accords?
So with regards to the peace accords, the main strategy, if you like, was always to drag their feet, to let the accord collapse under its own weight and sort of decry how difficult and maybe even unrealistic some people think the requirements are. Mm. Part of that is driven by the party's, Uribe's party's idea that the accords are too lenient in terms of giving, lenient sentences to ex-FARC, depending on how truthful and conciliatory they're going to be in the reconciliation process. So the main idea is always to let it sort of fall under its own weight. And that was the strategy already, even if Colombia had been able to, have these next 2 years unimpeded by a pandemic and an economic crisis. And now that we're in this pandemic and economic crisis, it only gives the government a little bit more fuel to say, oh, well, you know what? We're busy. There's only so much we can do. Our budget is tighter than it was before. Like in the next budget that we pass, we're going to be able to commit less funds than we originally expected. to this process, and you know, what are we supposed to do? Like, we're, our hands are tied.
Mm.
And so there's not really good reason for observers to expect meaningful progress on that front for the next 2 years.
Is it kind of been a, it's kind of almost been a safety net for them then on this front. It's just, you can willingly look away and just say the budget's not there. The budget's not there. And how can we, well, I guess, you know, how can we fault them on that? It's, it, we're in a very, very difficult situation right now, obviously here in Colombia. And okay. So, you know, we're over 300,000, well over 300,000 cases of the virus here. And, I want to say 11,000 deaths, tragedy is taking place where I am right now. As of the moment we are recording this, there are 25 cases and 3 or 4 deaths. There's, you know, we only have 5 ICU beds. There are no ventilators and there are no intensivist doctors. So, I mean, this is reflected throughout the country. Basically, and so I'm just wondering how we feel that this, the country might be able to, I don't even want to see rebound, is pick herself up after as the coronavirus sort of, it's not going to go away, but let's say winds down, that's becomes more manageable perhaps. How do we feel? I don't know who wants to answer this, Callum or Cameron or Sergio. How do we feel that the economy and Colombia can pick herself up again?
Well, look, I think one of the things that's required here is unity of effort. And it's a unity of effort that coronavirus was very adept at providing, because it's to nobody's fault, really, what happened, how it happened, how it spread, how contagious it is, the death rate, etc. So if we can all buckle up and move in the same direction, in a direction that reopens tourism, for example, or in a direction that provides a substantial safety net for people to be able to stay in their homes and not become contagious with the virus during a given amount of time, or a program that invests in the long-term reactivation of the economy, such as infrastructure spending that Colombia is lagging on quite significantly. But none of these things are on the table now. Mm. And I mean, because many of the things that we need to do is health reform, or pension reform, or labor reform. And these are all things that run through the political machine of Congress. And unfortunately, those cogs are not going to move as swiftly because of the events of last week.
Mm. Do we think, I mean, you know, we're in this coronavirus, there's no way around it, there's no way around not talking about it, and I apologize that we end up talking about it, but there's no way around this. You know, one thing, there are a couple of things that are always on Colombia's, you know, they're always on the table, and one of them is, of course, as you mentioned it, Sergio, health reform. It's a tough one. Was health reform in any way on President Duque's agenda, Cameron? Did we see him, or did we expect him to look at health reform as one of his key objectives in the final 2 years?
I don't think so. It wasn't anything that an expert mentioned to me in dozens of interviews that I conducted. You know, if anything, the reforms that, or the modifications of the healthcare system, were just patching up the holes that already exist. It's not really changing anything fundamental. One of those was, you know, even before this pandemic hit, a lot of hospitals across Colombia were in arrears on their payments to staff. So yeah. Staff were working without getting paid on time for their efforts, even into the beginning of the pandemic. You know, they're exposing themselves to this this virus, the likes of which we've never seen, and not even getting paid. And it's not like they're getting paid wages that are going to make them wealthy to begin with.
Mm.
So we signed an executive order, I think, a few months ago to authorize state funding for a bunch of the payment. But that's only, you know, fixing the leaky roof. That's not changing the system in any way that
yeah, it needs
benefits
to
the majority of Colombians going forward.
But they will call it a reform.
Yes.
They will advertise it as a huge endeavor that is completely revolutionary of the healthcare system. And look, we still have a long ways to go for these things to go through Congress. Mm. And quorums and, you know, political brinksmanship, all these are features of Colombian politics. I was telling Cameron, you know, a good government that has high approval ratings in a very good non-election year can make one reform go through, or two at the most, you know, healthcare or pensions or labor reform or tax reform or judicial reform. Not all five during the same legislature. Yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's not going to aim at health reform. As you say, he'll suggest that it's revolutionary, the health reform, but it will be much of the same, as you both say. So which one is he going to focus on then? What is the one? And I know I'm pointing you in one direction here, but what do we think will be the key reform that President Duque then focuses on, and I'm sure will be strong-armed into by the more vociferous members of his Democratic Center Party?
Judicial reform.
Yeah.
One court to rule them all.
And we, as you said, you know, if the law doesn't suit them, they'll look at trying to alter it so it does. So judicial reform, what can we say? We're going in. He can't run for a second term. This is something that's clarified, just to get it out there amongst my listeners. President Uribe was able to change laws in his first term, so that was in 2002 to 2006, to allow him to run, or allow a presidential candidate or to the incumbent to run again. He then tried to do it for a third time, but of course it didn't work. Santos then got in, ran for a second time, got in and won again, and then changed the law back. So you can only be a one-term president. Which, of course, you know, I, for me, it shows a certain degree of a lack of maturity in politics, but this is the nature of the beast. It's Latin America. There's the fear of the sort of dictatorial strongman taking the reins. But, I mean, what's to argue that we're not living this anyway? What's to argue this? So I find it very interesting, you know, this situation in which we live in Colombia. So we've got a one-term president. And I think we're at the halfway point of this period with, I don't want to say a complex character, because I don't think he is particularly complex, Iván Duque, but I think he's in a very, very tough situation. It's a thankless situation to be a political leader with a mentor of the style that he has, and of course through the coronavirus period. I mean, you'd want to be a leader without this, of course. So, I mean, do we feel potentially, I mean, maybe Cameron, that Duque's final 2 years will just result in him being kind of a lame duck president?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a strong possibility. That's what we're looking at. And the odds are in that favor, or pointing in that direction, he would say. Mm. I was thinking last week how to translate lame duck into Spanish. and it doesn't really have the same ring when you say a duck that can't fly, you know, or a duck that can't swim. In any case, that's what we're looking at. And I think it highlights a couple of tensions that you sort of picked up on already, which is, all right, well, president has a four-year term. Well, maybe another four-year term down the line, but for now, only one non-consecutive four-year term. And it changes the model of what an effective president has to look like.
Mm.
You know, the typical behavior during a campaign is to rail against your opponent.
Yeah.
There are undeniably bad ideas, you know, dubious legal stuff, right? We just throw rocks at each other in campaigning. And that's pretty standard. Well, it's pretty standard everywhere, it seems like. But it causes more problems down the line when you are functioning in this only one-term situation, and also in with this was like very multi-party system,
yeah.
you know, in which no matter what happens, you have to coalition build, right? So in a country with a two-party system, you might wind up having a Congress or a Senate that lines up with what you want. And so the idea that you need to coalition build doesn't really take precedence. But it's always going to take precedence as long as Colombia has so many parties and some of them can come and go so quickly. I think that Duque was hurt by this sort of old model, if you like, a couple of years ago. And then he gets into office and it takes a whole year to like rebuild the trust and the confidence and make some compromises, build a coalition that you need to push through the one reform that Sergio was talking about. And even that's no guarantee.
Hmm.
And so, you know, maybe in the future, candidates will look at that and go, well, all right, I need to change this strategy a little bit. Otherwise, I'm going to look like a lame duck so soon into my tenure as president. But to go back to your original question, yeah, I mean, I think that that's a very real possibility. I think put a gun to my head, that's what I would say.
Put a gun to your head. I want to say it's a pato cojo, like a limping duck or something like that. I don't know. I don't know if the translation works, but I like the idea of that. I'm going to have to do some research into that. But I mean, there must be a phrase in Spanish. They've got all sorts of phrases for this kind of thing. He's in a tough situation, as you say. Now, you're best placed. You're up there in Washington. And before we start sort of winding this down, but you're up there in Washington. I hear there's an election coming up in November. I mean, I haven't read anything about it, and I've seen no outrageous comments, and I've seen no tit for tat between President Trump and the Democratic, well, soon to be nominee Joe Biden. How do we feel? How do we feel that either one of those guys winning in November will be of effect, or how will this affect Colombia, Cameron?
Well, there's no doubt that a Biden presidency would lead to a change of the dialogue, at least, between the two countries. And what I mean by that is some of the efforts to sort of impede the progress of the peace accord and also to resume aerial fumigation of coca crops around the country are sort of encouraged, definitely encouraged by some of the chest-pounding rhetoric that our current president Trump engaged in, and sort of along with the, you know, war on drugs, you know, law and order sort of mentality. And the Biden campaign at the moment is signaled that it's going to place a lot more emphasis on carrying out part of the peace accords that are less popular with the right of Colombia, and also more oversight over the way that the military is using the funds and equipment that it's been given over these last, you know, it's been 15 or 20 years, right? I mean, there's been a long history of serious aid and serious equipment and manpower in some cases too, being funneled to Colombia to help fight all of these different battles at the same time. And, you know, the Biden administration wants to keep the pressure on some of those fronts, but also make sure that the aid and the equipment is being used properly as opposed to peeking into journalists' communications and even opposition politicians. And another thing that's part of the equation too that we haven't touched on is protecting social leaders in the rural areas, you know, to the minds of some Americans that represents a kind of negligence.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so the sort of the pressure, the dialogue is going to change even if the end goals are similar in many cases.
Very good. Sergio?
No, I fully subscribe to what Cameron was saying. I don't have anything to add.
Okay. Well, I think I think there's a really interesting element, and of course, especially of what's happened in recent weeks, as you know, having someone as recognized and internationally sort of, let's say, social media savvy as AOC making a claim in the Congress and making that statement is a big deal. You know, maybe in the when we look at, you know, 100 years of Colombia, it's just something that's been thrown out there. But for us down here to have a you know, let's say a junior Congress member actually taking an interest in someone who does get the ear of, I would say, a millennial, you know, population, that's a big deal. And that, you know, she's not afraid of putting pressure, you know, and she would definitely, you know, jump on Biden if it were he not to adhere to, or at least say the right things. I think it's very interesting that there could be a new rhythm, let's say, a new conversation, as you say, Cameron, maybe with the same end result, but again, with the right things said, to placate certain people here and there. I think it would be a very interesting change. I'm always very concerned about what's going to happen with a further Trump presidency, but I'm also concerned about what would happen with a Biden presidency. I mean, Colombia, we're in such a state of flux. I think it's continual flux that we just don't really know. I mean, it's all about the government in question. And then it brings us to that, without mentioning coronavirus, which I do, but it brings us to Venezuela. Which will end up being, again, another key point to any presidency that comes out of November's election, and Colombia being the pinnacle of U.S. Companionship in the region, or an ally in the region. I suppose that Bolsonaro is trying to jetty for that position, but let's leave him out of this equation right now. How do we feel that the Venezuela question might unravel? I read something the other day that the Trump administration is ready to back Guaido further. But his star is in decline. I mean, let's not lie. There's no two ways about it. His sheen has very much lost its luster. So I don't know. I mean, anyone want to comment on the Venezuela and future Colombia-Venezuela-U.S. relations?
I mean, all the indications from the Biden campaign were to be successful is that their emphasis would be on a much more multilateral approach. And so what that means is, more attempts to engage with an international coalition, be that the UN, or even possibly talking to NATO partners. And that sort of stands in contrast to what we've seen from the Trump administration so far, which is sort of, how to put it generally, pounding our chest, empty threats pounding our chest, sort of an unwillingness to engage with international partners to remove Maduro, and what some might say is sort of ineffective sanctions regime. I think that the expectation was that the economic sanctions put on certain members of the government were a nice idea in theory to target people in power while also not harming the livelihood or the well-being of Venezuelans at large, right? That's why you enact targeted sanctions as opposed to an entire economy or a blockade or, that sort of thing. And it's clear that while those might have been nice ideas, they've been largely ineffective in removing the people from power who people are looking to get out. And also they've had pretty minimal effect in maintaining any sort of standard of living for Venezuelans. So it's hard to think how they could be worse, right? Some people would say, oh, well, if we didn't have the sanctions in place, it would be worse. It's kind of a hard argument to make. So the main idea is probably a rethinking of the sanctions regime and also more attempts at building international coalition, kind of a toning down of the rhetoric in the short term.
Definitely. More than a month ago, I drove out from Bogota to the coast and the road out as far as Bucaramanga there was just a steady flow of Venezuelans returning to Venezuela. Just heartbreaking to watch. And as you say, how could the situation, it's just awful to watch. Six-year-old kids walking in the blazing sunshine with their parents with tiny backpacks. A mother was wheeling her two children in a pushchair that was designed for a doll. It was just horrific. I want to stop and pick up, but I can't. There's no space. There's nothing, and we just stopped to give people water and so on. But if we move on from the
and this is the final point here. We move on and we're looking back at your report. Again, I recommend to anyone and everyone out there, check out the Columbia Risk Analysis website, and you get access to the report there, defining his legacy. Of course, you can sign up for a Columbia Risk Analysis newsletter and updates, and then you'll get it directly into your inbox without having to search. Let's just quickly talk. Final 2 years. Who are we putting forwards as the potential presidential candidates, Sergio?
Succession. In a polarized environment, as it is, without having to throw any, Uribe bombs into question, I would say that right now it's more of an extreme political direction that we're seeing. So we're seeing Gustavo Petro, current senator, former presidential candidate who made it to the second round last year. He's positioned himself as the alternative to Duque since day one. And he's been casting everything that is not entirely Petrista as neoliberal, Uribista, paramilitary, human rights violating scum. And on the other hand, you have the more extreme people who say, Duque, he's a good guy, he has good intentions, but he's not right wing enough. So we need more of a hardliner policy to get us through. And the truth is, those extremes feed off each other, and they're going to try to make as much noise as possible before next year. The big part of the problem is that in the middle, you don't really have a candidate can also bring together much of the people who don't see the things the same way. And so if you have, like we have now in our report, a potpourri of candidates on the right, a solid 3 or 4 candidates on the middle, and a very defined left wing, you're going to have these divisions determine who makes it to the second round. And the ones that are probably going to make it to the second round are the ones who espouse the most extreme views. And even if they espouse the most extreme views, I think it's going to be very difficult for Colombians to elect Gustavo Petro as president. And I know that this is going to cause a lot of heartache with many online Twitter accounts that are just an egg. But I think that Petro lost his moment. Petro lost his opportunity. But I also don't see anybody on the center convincingly get the support of people on the left and people on the right who you need to bring this country together.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is, and I'll finish with this, and this is going to sound poetic or whatever, but Uribe is not a man. Uribe is an ideology. Uribe is what Perón is to Argentina. Uribe is what Franco is to Spain, right? Uribe is a mainstay in our political discourse going forward. Uribe is what Chávez was to Venezuela. You cannot have Colombian politics without considering Uribismo. And so for much that many people may want them to disappear from the map or just see Uribe wither and grow old and retire to his finca, it's going to be there.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to work with them, not around them, not despite them, with them, if we want a united country. And I think that whoever understands that and is able to message their way without being on the left or without espousing radical ideas may have a decent chance of being their next president. But I don't really have names to offer that I would say at this point, this is the runner-up. Mm. This is the candidate that I think is going to win. But maybe we can have another podcast next year.
Oh, definitely. We'll definitely get back. And I think you're totally right on that. It's like, it's this Uribismo
is here. It's again, as you say, very poetic. Very poetic indeed, Sergio, to end on that note. And I think there's no better way than to end on that note and say, listen, thank you so much both to Cameron Wilson and to Sergio Guzman. Uribismo is here to stay. Thank you to you both. Sorry for that Freudian slip there. As we say, the Columbia Risk Analysis Report defining his legacy was written for the most part by Cameron Wilson there, master student at Johns Hopkins, working at the moment for Columbia Risk Analysis. Do check it out. It's a very complete, very good report. And in the light of what's happened in this last week, it's still well worth reading because it puts a lot of things into context. Director of Columbia Risk Analysis, Sergio Guzman, is a good friend to the podcast. He's been on several times now. And of course, if you've read about Columbia, you will have read quotes by him. So again, a great honor to have him on the show, giving his time and his thoughts. So both of you there, thank you so much for your time. This has been a great podcast. Next year, when coronavirus is winding down and everything's back to normal, we'll have you on talking about the potential for the elections the following year in Colombia. So thank you again for being on Colombia Calling.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Richard.
It's been a great pleasure. This has been Colombia Calling, episode 337. I'm Richard McCall in Mompós, Bolívar, 6 hours south from Cartagena, sweating away in the sweltering lowlands next to the Magdalena River. But yes, we've been talking politics. And of course, we'll be back next week. Next week, we're going to be talking about the region of Urabá, the challenges facing that region, and of course, the ecology, environment. And well, it's a very endemic and special region of Colombia. And we have an academic from Medellin talking about that with us. So thank you again, and keep on listening to the podcast. Bye-bye.